Hello and welcome to Cage Club, two fans, 76 movies, one cage. This is episode 66, Seeking Justice, from 2011. I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski, and with us today we have Christian Larson back. It's been a while, it's been about 15 years, in cage years.
Wow, yeah, I guess it has.
But in terms of reality, it's only been a couple months, but welcome back, Larson.
Yeah, it's good to be back, and as I was saying to Joey earlier, it's an interesting way to bookend my three appearances, because the first movie I came here to talk about, I went in blind.
Birdie.
It ended up being surprisingly amazing. Second movie I was prepared for, it was The Rock. It was the movie that I signed up for.
Sure.
And it was great. And this is another one I went in blind for, and my reaction was almost exactly the opposite of Birdie, but we'll get into that. So anyway, it's good to be back.
I do want to make a note that if this audio sounds a little different, because this is the first Cage Club, we're recording live in person. I can actually see Mike. I can actually see Larson. It's very exciting, and now there should be less gaps and less awkward fills, even though I edit all that out, you know, there's going to be less work for me to do, in theory,
because
I can see when you guys want to talk.
In theory.
It's a nice theory. Hopefully it'll play out in practice. This is a little surreal, though.
It's a little weird, but it's also great.
Oh, it's terrific. And our first direct-to-DVD movie?
Yes. Well, I was telling Larson that this movie was in theaters somewhere, because it made $400,000 in the U.S.
Okay.
Made about, I want to say, like $8 million or something. It made like a decent amount overseas. I don't think it made back its budget, though.
Okay.
I think its budget was $17 million. So, I mean, I can't imagine they marketed too much, but, you know, it was in theaters somewhere. I don't know where. What I love about this movie is one of the first lines in the movie is, "Are you wasting my time?" And I was like, is this movie wasting our time? But it turns out, I don't know about you guys, I was blown, like, I was expecting nothing, and I wound up enjoying this movie so much more than I did. Like, the first 10 minutes with Cage and January Jones, just, like, before shit hits the fan, like, when life is good, it's great. Like, Cage is being so goofy and over the top. We've got Cage, we've got the beautiful January Jones, and we have Guy Pearce as, like, a pretty cool Cage villain.
Yeah, definitely, and we're back in New Orleans.
Back in NOLA.
So, you know, he's always knocking it out of the park when he's down there.
Cage turf.
Cage even says, "We love NOLA. Who dat?" And it's like, yeah. Oh, okay, like, that's like a, you know, if you don't know the Saints, you might not know that, but he's so into that line read, I just love it.
Oh, come on, we love New Orleans. Who dat?
Watching this movie about halfway through, I realized I had a thesis for this movie.
Okay, what's your thesis?
And my thesis is that I recently listened to your review of National Treasure.
Okay.
And National Treasure is a compilation of cliches that works. It's a bunch of generic cliches thrown together in a way that works. And I feel like this combines every generic cliche of a conspiracy thriller and throws it all together and puts it in a blender. And the first element is that he has a perfect life.
Yeah.
With a beautiful wife. He's a nice guy.
To have a baby.
They're planning to have a baby. He has a great job where he's mentoring inner city children. Something bad is going to happen to one or both of them. And it does.
Right from the beginning, like, every time January Jones smiles, I'm like, oh no, she's not going to get killed, is she? And it's almost worse that we're jumping a little bit ahead of ourselves, but
yeah.
She gets carjacked, raped. But now here's a question for you guys, and this is sort of a movie-long thing, that it seems like everyone we meet in this movie is part of this conspiracy. Was she attacked as part of the conspiracy?
That's going to have to come at the end. Like, well, once we cover the whole movie, then we have to talk about what the purpose of this conspiracy is, because it seems to have really very little purpose whatsoever except to cause the movie.
I think we also have to take into account what this title really means and who it applies to. I thought it would have applied to Cage's character,
right.
But it turns out there's an organization called, like, the Justice Seekers, who go out of their way to
take revenge for, you know, mild-mannered guys like this who are just English professors who sort of don't have the nerve. and then they get roped up in that sort of lifestyle along the lines of some sort of payback and favors and things like that. But yeah, I was getting like elements of the game here too and stuff. And I always love a good conspiracy thriller. And I feel like this is done right. Joey, one thing we usually complain about is pace. And one thing about this movie, like a lot happens in a short amount of time.
This movie, I think going back to like what Larson was saying, like this movie, the way it begins, it's sort of a cliche that there's just like video footage and we don't know what is of who these people are. And all we know is that the hungry rabbit jumps. Which was originally going to be, supposedly, the original name of this movie, before it was called Teen Justice, was not named The Hungry Rabbit Jumps.
Another thing about the opening of this movie that I thought kind of set me up for it being low budget was that the font was like one of the 12 fonts that come with Microsoft Word. It was like the techno font. And it opens up with like camcorder footage of a witness, and it's got that like Final Cut plug-in that makes it look like a camcorder with the, like the recording thing in the corner. So I was like,
that might even be the same font as the title card.
I mean, this is definitely a much lower budget than we've been used to, I feel. But then right after that is a pretty engaging scene for me. The guy who we saw on camera is getting into his car in the parking garage, and a guy bumps his car off the top level and kills him, and that's pretty cool looking stunt there.
Yeah, the action scenes in this are very well done. I can't say much for the writing personally or the scenes in between the action scenes, but the action scenes are great.
The budget for this movie was $17 million, and I think it looks good for being a $17 million movie. That there are like a good number of action scenes. There's excitement on screen. We also get a couple things, a couple callbacks early on in the movie. We get Cage compromising January Jones in bed. I guess January Jones maybe is just attracted to less than beautiful people, because Cage is not great looking in this. And on The Last Man on Earth, she's dating Todd, who is very great, likable guy, but not the most beautiful man. So I just feel like, because January Jones is like the perfection of, like, she's just beautiful. She's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And also, you know, later when she gets beat up, I'm like, she better get out of this ugly makeup fast, because I don't want to see January Jones with like a swollen eye the entire movie.
Well, I don't really know her from anything more than Mad Men, right? And to be quite honest,
she was in that one X-Men movie.
She was in an X-Men film, but, you know, like a lot of secondary characters, she didn't talk in that movie, and you really didn't get a sense of what she could do. And I was quite surprised with her abilities here at the start of the film. I was like, you know, wasn't really expecting too much, because I had just heard that, you know, she's not a good actress,
right.
And I was like, but she is. Like, I just think those people might have gotten tired of her one character on Mad Men, but I definitely feel like she's doing a good job here.
Yeah, she's definitely more than just a pretty face. Like, she's holding her own this movie, and I'm not really sure where this ranks in terms of the Diane Kruger effect, because she, like, the whole inciting incident is that she is taken advantage of, and she's raped, and she's beaten, and she's essentially left for dead.
Right.
So that's not great, but I think she kind of has, and like, and then throughout the movie, you know, she's fearful of, rightfully so, but she's fearful of the outside world, she wants to make sure her doors are locked. Like, it makes sense, but I'm not sure if it's, like, a strong woman character, or if she's just, once again, an object to move the plot along.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's probably the latter.
I think it's a little complex, which is kind of good, you know? She ends this film in a completely different place than she begins it after her assault, you know, and her recovery. You know, she starts taking gun lessons, right? And at the end, she ends up saving her husband from dying and stuff. So she becomes really, like, well, you know, we've been getting ahead of ourselves a little, but my point is,
like, you're right.
She becomes very empowered by the end of this film. Her and Cage almost switch places emotionally as far as their fears and paranoia about someone's coming after you.
It's kind of like Amber Heard. We just talked about Drive Angry, but Amber Heard saves Cage at the end of that movie, or she actually saves him throughout the movie. And here, once again, we get, you know, a very attractive blonde woman saving Cage's ass. So it's pretty cool to see that kind of trend instead of just terrible female character after terrible female character.
We see Cage as the English teacher. We see him giving a big speech about violence, Shakespeare using violent language, and him telling his inner city students that it's better to express your violence through words than through actions. And that, right away, I was like, oh, I get it. Like, he's going to have to get violent later, and he's going to be conflicted about it. Like, it's all so Death Wish, like, setting it up. Like, this guy is going to have to avenge something.
But what's kind of cool is he doesn't ever go full Charlie Bronson in this film, right? Like, he's always, like, a very tentative, you know, participant in all of this. Like, it's really when it comes down to his wife's life or, you know, something severe, then he has to comply. But, yeah. I find that you're right. They are definitely introducing that theme right here at the top, and you know, he's like breaking up fights between his students.
Yeah,
and
like
that was
even
great.
When there's a scene where he's playing chess with his best friend, and his best friend is like, "Oh, you play too safe. You've got to take some risks."
Yes. Down. Yep.
Yeah, and like, oh, I wonder if that's gonna come into it.
Checkmate and mate.
I didn't see that coming.
Yo, your problem, my man, is you play too safe. You gotta take some chances, you know. Play not to lose. Pretty much ensures defeat.
Set him up, asshole.
And also, there's a theme early on about phones, about turning your phones off. Like, the phones play a big part in this, I think. And it's 2010 or 2011.
Well, it's 2011. It was probably filmed in 2010.
And everyone's still using these little Nokia phones.
But the video that they shoot on the phone, like, Cage films a video of a video playback and sends it to Guy Pearce, and it's basically HD quality. Like, it's just, like, flawlessly shot.
And it's on, like, a 2002-era Nokia phone.
Like, iPhones were out at this time. Like, just use an iPhone.
Yeah. I guess it's a product placement thing, but...
Yeah, Nokia must have paid a lot of money. This was before they were gobbled up by Microsoft. So they were scrapping for every new customer they could get.
What can we get? This Nick Cage movie? Sure, sign us up.
But yeah, his friend is Harold Perrineau, who was... Oh. We keep bringing up Lost. He was Michael on Lost. You know, doesn't shout Walt once in this movie, but he is the same guy, also from the Matrix sequels. But it was good to see him. Another sort of surprising guest star... I don't want to call it a guest star, but Jennifer Carpenter, who plays Dexter's sister Deb on Dexter.
Oh, yes, yes.
And so what's crazy about this movie is that they sort of set up from the beginning that Cage has a sister.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, you know, it's Jennifer Carpenter. Like,
yeah, me
you know.
Too, yeah.
And then at the very end of the movie, they're like, don't make me fly to Philadelphia and get your sister. I was like, wait, how is Jennifer Carpenter not his sister? Jennifer Carpenter is just January Jones's best friend? Like, why is that needless complication in this plot? Like, just, you already have a character who's, like, there... And then by like toward the end of the movie, they're like, you know, January Jones, you know, your best friend, Jennifer Carpenter. I'm like, wait,
I have a sort of theory about that because it doesn't make much sense for her not to be the sister.
Right.
But then I was like, well, you know, this organization is going to try and, you know, threaten him and blackmail him. And eventually they're going to try and kidnap the people he loves and stuff like that. So perhaps they were just like, you know, if his sister lives in town and his wife, these guys are going to have to kidnap two people instead of one.
I guess.
That's sort of where my mind went to rationalize it. But you're definitely right.
It's funny that it took 57 movies to get a sister. And now we have two sisters in like 8 movies. Like, Cage sister count doubling thanks to Seeking Justice. But I wrote down that after she gets carjacked, after January Jones gets carjacked and raped and brought to the hospital, Jennifer Carpenter shows up, Harold Perrineau shows up, everybody's like, oh my god, like, what's happening? And then I wrote down, it's time for Cage to seek justice. And he's just got to go out there and just, you know, make sure that justice is wrought upon him. But before he can even, like, make a decision, Guy Pearce shows up.
Oh, wait, hold on, man. Before that, I thought... We got something I haven't seen in a Cage movie in a long time, maybe since The Family Man, shedding the tears on screen, right?
Yeah,
he sits down next
to
his wife, and they come out for real.
And he sobs a few lines. He's like, give me some time with my wife. Just like, he's into this.
Yeah.
You know, straight to DVD or not, like, he's committed to this movie.
Yeah, and that's the thing I didn't really know what to think about this movie when I was done with it, like... So I read a lot of reviews, and the reviews were very split. And I read, this was one of Roger Ebert wrote a review of this. Hmm. It was one of his last reviews.
Oh, wow.
And he was saying that you can say a lot of things about this movie, but the one thing you can't say is that Nicolas Cage wasn't trying. He's making the best of it.
I think the critical split is important to note because Metacritic only has 38, which is not a good number.
No.
But IMDb users give it a 6.2. Like, people like this. Critics might not like it, but I think people like this movie.
It feels like one of the movies people will just sort of not even think of because of its DVD stabs me, but like if you actually sit down and like give this movie a chance, like it really won me over. You know, I could only really think like sometime in the late in the second act, I was kind of like, all right, let's get it together. But then in the third act, they really do pull it together.
Wow. Well, I hope you guys win me over by the end of this because I hated this.
So this,
I respect your opinion. Well, so let's keep going.
Well, Joey knows this. You might not be quite as aware, but I'm starting to lose it as we get here into the back nine of Cage Club.
His sanity is slipping by the wayside.
Oh, no.
In an era where Cage does a lot of these straight-to-DVD movies with really generic titles, like we get this, we get Seeking Justice, Stolen, Trespass, all these different movies. I know that you haven't seen any more movies, or any more from this point on. These are all new to you. This one is, like, leaps and bounds better than some of his other movies.
No.
So, I mean, I know that that's sort of, like, bad, but, like, I really, like, I was expecting it to sort of be...
This is the best we can expect.
No, there's still good stuff to come. Yeah. But
here's how I kind of feel about it. It's like, all right, and on the Season of the Witch episode, you know, I was talking, like, what kept me going with that is sort of they're trying to do, like, this fantasy genre, you know, Middle Ages kind of thing. And, you know, no matter what the movie is, I'll always sort of give it a chance if they're doing that. And I feel like this is like, okay, we're trying to do this thriller thing, and this pulls that off much better than Season of the Witch pulled that off.
Right.
You know? So, like, this is even, you know, leaps and bounds from stuff he's done already, I feel.
Well, because the director's sort of an established guy. I mean, he did more recently than this, but he did The November Man, that sort of...
Oh, okay.
Like, it wasn't, like, a great movie, but it's like...
James Bond was in it.
Yeah, Pierce Brosnan, like, as, like, post-James Bond, basically as James Bond, kind of, a little bit.
Kind of.
He also did, I think, Species, and he did Cocktail. So, like, he's done, like, big movies. It's not like some guy who just, like, some upstart. On the other hand, the two people who wrote this movie have basically never written anything else ever, before or after. So, you know, the directing, I think it looks great. I think it's competently made. If you have problems with sort of the generic, you know, throw it in a blender plot, that's more the writing than the directing or the acting. I think.
Well, I mean, getting into the writing, this actually there's this thing called the Blacklist, where they a bunch of people get together and they read unreleased scripts, and this was one of their favorites, a movie that floated around for years and was never made. This was a beloved Blacklist script. And the script is probably the least of the things I like about this movie, because it's so generic. Getting into that, getting back to the film itself, after his wife gets beaten and raped, he's approached by Guy Pearce, who gives him... it's very, very much like the meeting between Billy Bob Thornton and Martin Freeman in Fargo, where this mysterious guy offers revenge to this meek man who's just come across something terrible.
You know where he is.
We do, but we have a time issue, so we would have to get an answer from you pretty quickly. Listen, we're just a few citizens who are seeking justice. You know, we love this city, we're tired of watching it go to hell.
Initially he says no, but then he's like, all right. And he's like, well, if you really want my help, you have to go downstairs and buy two candy bars.
Two forever bars. Because this is forever. Can't take it back.
Yeah. From this vending machine. And he does. And it's like such...
Well, I hear you. You know, I don't disagree with you. It's needlessly complex.
Yeah.
Okay, but I think there's a reason for that, right? We sort of learned that Guy Pearce's character, Simon, who's sort of in charge of this cell...
Which, hold on, by the way, why do they never say Simon Says at any point in this movie?
Yeah.
They need to drop that line at least once.
And that's not even the character's real name, we come to find out.
Yeah,
he's
in
something,
he's
right?
He's got another name.
Ugh.
And, I mean, the double names in Cage movies aren't that uncommon, but I wasn't expecting it here. and you know, he's definitely bringing it too. He's menacing, he's scary, and he's all those things. So I feel like he's elevating these cliches to a degree of watchability, you know, something that someone else couldn't quite pull off, but Guy Pearce is working it, you know, he's doing a good bad guy job.
Oh, he's very sinister. He does a very good job.
I was just looking back at through the past few movies that we've done, and we really haven't had... I mean, I know that the bad guy in this movie is sort of this shadowy organization we don't know a lot about, but he's the face of it. We haven't really had, like, a bad guy, or, like, a compelling bad guy in a long, long time. Like, it's never been Cage against somebody. And I know it's sort of him against kind of the world, you know what I mean? But, like, we haven't had, like... a villain, like a bad leader. And like, I think Guy Pearce, like, it's something that a lot of movies do, like they have, like, you know, sort of the guy that he's going against, and like, we just haven't had that lately. Yeah.
Well, this guy is much better than the Reverend King from Drive Angry. You know, that guy was just not formidable whatsoever. I mean, and then even going back to like Alfred Molina in Sorcerer's Apprentice, like, he's a bad guy, but he isn't the bad guy of the movie. You know, it's like Morgana and stuff. Like, they're trying to resurrect Gozer in that film, like, quite literally. and so you're right. Like, it's interesting to see him have someone to face off against.
There's a lot of scenes in this movie where there's like this manufactured tension. It's a very tense scene, and the one where he buys the candy bars, he walks into the cafeteria, and there's ominous music, and he's looking around.
And that security guard.
And it's another one of those cliched scenes where a guy is paranoid, and he walks into a room. There's a close-up of every random person in the room looking at him, and he's like, one of these people is watching me.
And one was.
One was. The sinister bald guy who shows up in every scene.
The one guy you expect to be watching is the guy who's watching.
But one of the things about this scene is, as he's buying the candy bars, the security guard is so into him buying these candy bars. Like, he's watching him. First he's like, tilts his head, and he's like, watching him, and then he walks over and talks to him about the candy bar, and it's like...
He's like, you like the nutritious stuff, right? I was almost like, is he going to ask for one of those candy bars?
Yeah.
Well, I think... Okay, so to play devil's advocate for a minute, because this scene is bad. Like, it's not a great scene. But if you're a security guard and you're basically there, I mean, you're in a hospital. It's not like there's crazy stuff going on. You're there just in case something happens.
Mm-hmm.
But if you see a guy walk into your room and, like, looking around, and then as he's just, you know, the harmless act of buying a candy bar, looks your way 6 or 7 times, like, you're going to be, you know, he could be, like, a friendly approach, be like, hey, guy, like, you know, what's going on? Like, just want to make sure you're not, like, losing your mind now. So as terrible as the scene is written, I can see, as a security guard, Cage is acting horribly fishy in the scene. Like, you know, it should be on the security guard, you know, not to go up there and, you know, maybe stir the pot and be like, hey, like, you okay? But just, you know, make sure that the guy's normal. Like, have a conversation with him.
Yeah.
So I don't think the scene does it well, but I can see sort of how it could be done well.
Well, it definitely establishes that Nicolas Cage, for the entirety of the film from this point, looks sketchy all the time. Like, he's casting glances on the side. He's, like, sneaking around. He looks nervous.
Well, because, like, he's new to this world, right? Because when Guy Pearce first shows up to him, he's like, hey, you want us to, like, take care of that guy for you? He's like, take care of him. You mean, like, arrest him? The guy's like, no, like come on, Cage. Like, even if you're, like, the nerdiest, you know, not like a dad, but basically like a dad type, like, everybody knows what take care of a guy means. Like, he's just so removed from this world that he, you know, he is nervous because he's, like, in over his head, and, you know, the justice that he's seeking is something that he's not used to getting.
Yeah, I feel like he's constantly got a lot to process, right? Like, every time he feels like he might have a handle on it, like, there's something new to figure out, and like, here it's like, yeah, his wife was just, you know, almost killed, and then suddenly some stranger comes up and offers to murder the rapist. It's like, how do you act normal after that situation? You know, I give some more credit to that whoever wrote the security guard in on him.
Yeah,
you know, following through on their promise that not too long after Cage says okay, we find out that justice was carried out, that the guy who raped and left January Jones for dead, the guy that we see again a little bit later in the movie, just bursts into his apartment and just shoots him in the head and makes it look like a suicide.
Yeah.
Like, this whole citizen seeking justice group, their whole MO, it's the same thing every time. It's, let's kill this guy and make it look like a suicide. So they're just like shady guys all over the city, or not even shady guys, and that's the whole thing, right? They're just normal guys that, you know, were approaching time of weakness, and then they're told that whoever they're after is a pedophile or a serial killer, like, whatever. It's just, like, some terrible, terrible thing that they need to dispose of. It's like, oh, of course, you know, you're telling me that the man who raped my wife will be killed if I kill a pedophile? Like, that'll make my decision easier. But it's not actually a pedophile. It's just some other guy who was in the same situation you were in, and they're just twisting it. Like, their whole sense of morality is weird.
Yeah. They're always kind of covering their tracks. Like, that's what I get about this organization. Like, they don't want to do any of the dirty work themselves. So what I did kind of think was cool, though, is like, okay, so they'll take care of this problem for you, and you owe them a favor. And it turns out the favor is you sort of have to, like, kill the next guy when the next guy's wife gets, like, murdered or beaten. Like, then they send you to take care of that guy.
It's almost theoretically. And like, in theory, that works.
Yeah.
But the whole point of it is that Simon has perverted it to use that to his own needs.
Yeah. It's almost like Bangkok Dangerous, right? Where there's always one guy removed.
Yeah.
And so you don't really know. Like, you see Simon, you see Guy Pearce, but you don't know who else is involved. When it turns out that everybody else is involved.
Well, I think that's the problem, is like, for a secret society, like, you know, everybody's in on it. I mean, like, Fight Club did a better job of, like, keeping Project Mayhem a secret.
Well, yeah, because in Fight Club, like, people, like, whisper, like, hello, Mr. Durden, or whatever. Here, they're just like, hey, guys, you know, the hungry rabbit jumps. Like, you know what I mean?
Let him go.
I mean, that's why I was saying we should probably spend the deconstruction of the conspiracy to the end, because we could spend an entire episode talking about, like, the organization behind this crazy conspiracy, and, like, what are their resources? Like, who's funding this?
They've got,
like,
everything at their resources.
They have people everywhere, and, like, what do they get out of this? Like, what is
Well,
their...
it seems like, at least Simon's getting, like, satisfaction. Yeah. Like, that's what it seems. Like, it's all been built upon just, like, gratification for a job well done. Like, taking out the dregs of society, like... other people, like, he has that great speech at the end, right? His big stand up moment where he's on the hill, and he's just like, you know, people sit at home and get fat and watch TV, and
we'll get to that. But I mean, like, who's funding this? They have people everywhere. They're like, every time there's a scene in this movie, there's a guy in a black SUV on the corner, like, watching the scene happen.
Well, I feel like maybe, I mean, this was the same question I asked in Kick-Ass, and you pointed out, maybe when they have somebody kill a guy, maybe, you know, some other favors, like, rob that guy, or take, because, I mean, a guy kills himself, people aren't going to notice if, you know, jewelry is gone, or cash is gone, or whatever. Yeah. Maybe they're not only killing these guys, but taking a little bit of money or electronics they could flip. Who knows? Or maybe he's just independently... He looks like the kind of guy who's independently wealthy, who's never needed to worry about, you know... I mean, aside from writing letters to Santa Claus and whatever, you know, he's the guy who's never had to worry about money, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, when I really tried to think hard about it, which made my head hurt, I was like, well, there's probably, like, some kind of... like, senator at the head of all this, using, like, private resources and things like that, or, you know, there's, like, some kind of hedge fund.
Or taxpayer dollars, thanks Obama.
Well, I think about, like, again, I'm bringing up Kingsman, we do it a lot, but the way Kingsman sort of originated was, it was all of these tailors who lost their masters in World War One, and so they pooled their resources and created, like, the secret organization. Maybe it's something along that line.
I think the theories that we're coming up with are more entertaining than...
I'll tell you, I don't think they even thought of it.
Yeah,
like,
no,
let's just
no.
give him someone that everybody has to answer to someone, so we don't have to settle on someone to answer to.
So let's get back to the actual narrative of the film.
We jump 6 months
we're
later.
We're getting very theoretical.
So after January Jones gets out of the hospital, they go back, and she is sort of skittish, and then they jump 6 months later. And their first date out... of course, it has to go play pool at a bar.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, pools come up in, I don't know, 5 or 6 Cage movies, maybe even more. And there's one line in here that I love. Cage says to January Jones, "Oh, poo on you, I missed." And it's like, what? Like, who? I don't know if that's his line or if that's in the script, but the way he delivers it, I guess that's just sort of like, hey, look at this dorky guy. He's going to have to go kill a guy. Oh, poo on you?
Well, I think of, like, Vampire's Kiss, where he had to say, like, boo-hoo, right? And he's always trying to think of, like, creative and different ways to say things. Like, you know, take something like that and say it in a way where no one would ever think to hear it or something. Maybe it was just one of his self-imposed challenges of some kind.
And also, that was another scene that, like actually legitimately I was like, these guys have a great relationship. They're out there playing pool together, they're like doing shots together, like they're a great couple.
I feel like the January Jones, they got her a little conflicted here 6 months later, because like Cage comes home and she's like, you lock the door, you lock the windows, like you lock up, and then yet she's out at the bar and he disappears for a couple like minutes, and she's just where you been?
When,
like,
he disappears, I thought something was going to happen to her again,
totally.
And then nothing does.
It just seems a little weird that she's like totally cool about being out and about without him for a while, but yet when they're both home alone, like, she needs to have the doors
locked. Yeah, because even, like, 6 months later, she's still, like, sort of skittish, which makes sense, which is totally okay.
Yeah, of course.
But it's weird. But, yeah, so he leaves because he gets the call from Guy Pearce, and he's like, you need to go to the zoo at this time and mail this letter. And then he goes to the zoo, he's like, okay, no, actually open the letter, and you have to follow these people around. And this is whole part of their plot. We find out later that they send two guys to the zoo, and one films Cage, and so, like, they all have, like, all this evidence that makes it look like they're in over their head, that they can turn over the cops and get these guys killed. But it just, it's cool, like, it's sort of like the beginning of the movie, like, it's cool, but it's also, like, a little bit too vague and convoluted.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of what's going on. And another elephant back from Bangkok Dangerous.
Yeah, this is where I kept thinking, like, needlessly complex, you know? Like, I feel like if he had just mailed the letter, that would have been enough for the scene, and then they could have called him again and told him to, you know, follow somebody, or someone else could have contacted him. But it does seem like it goes on a bit long in a weird way. But the one thing I do like is how they sort of implicate their guy. Like, they're trying to implicate him while he's working, you know? So, like, they have stuff on him in case, like, he tries to, you know, tell anybody about
it. Well, not even in case that he wants to tell anybody about it, but just, like, to get rid of him at the end, like we were talking about before,
just
to wipe him off, that as soon as he's done, as soon as, like, the previous job is done, then they can have this guy killed because they have connections on the Force and everything.
Yeah, I mean, that's another conspiracy movie cliche, is, like, having a guy that you always have blackmail for so you can keep him doing stuff.
After he goes, he sort of bails at the zoo, like, he's not going to follow through, and he goes back to his classroom, and he finds out that Simon had been in his classroom and wrote his phone number on the board. And it's like, oh, okay. And then he just walks outside, and Simon's just, like, hanging out.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, okay, like, this is just, like, you know, this is what's happening now.
Yeah.
That we're going to hang out with Simon, and Simon's like, why didn't you do that? He's like, well, I did what you asked. I went to the zoo. And Simon says, a promise is a promise. You're not off the hook yet. Like, we killed the guy for you. You think, like, going to the zoo and, like, watching a woman for 10 minutes is, like, gonna... Like, we're not even. We're far from even.
I told you I couldn't do it.
Will, you know what a child pornographer does. He arranges for adult men to have sex with children and videotapes it.
I get it. He's the scum of the earth. Needs to get what's coming to him. But I'm not the guy to do it. I am not a killer.
Well, let's not forget what we did for you.
I wasn't myself that night. Nobody said anything in the agreement about killing anybody. So get the hell out of my life.
Yeah, and I understand how this might seem, like, kind of taking too long, you know, that's how it kind of feels for me a little bit, but it also feels sort of necessary for the story. I don't feel like he would have done the job the first time. Like, I don't feel like he would, you know, he seems like the kind of guy who is going to try and wiggle out of his duties here, even though they're not quite his responsibility, but in a way, he asked for it, and now he's not, like, paying the price.
Yeah, it does feel like it's taking a little bit long, but it's also believable in the sense that Cage, like, as just a normal guy, even with a group that did something like this for him, he's not going to just want to go ahead and just kill a guy. Like, he doesn't want to do that. So it does take a little bit long, but I think that also serves a purpose in the movie. It just, he's hesitant, and so the movie sort of has to hesitate. I think that, you know, like Tobin said, I think on one episode, you know, to show a character being bored, you don't have to make the movie boring. Like, you can do it in a better way. Here, I think it's like close to being good, but it also still does feel like it's taking a little bit too long.
You know, it feels like there should be, like, a chase scene here or something like that. Like, we should introduce, like, a little bit of a foot chase, or at least someone, like, following him and stuff. Because as it is, right, like, someone just, like, hands off a folder to him. Like you said, like, Simon's waiting for him outside. Like, I feel like Simon is exposing himself way too much in this situation.
What you could also do is that you start off the movie with this, you know, this footage of the, we find out, is the investigative journalist, like, weave some of that kind of stuff through, like, this sort of a through line of conspiracy thriller that builds up to this big conflict or, you know, climax at the end. Like, there's just, like, a little bit here in the middle that's just sort of sluggish.
I don't know if this already happened, but his wife decides to get a gun.
Yeah.
And this is another sort of, not so much a cliche, but the whole Chekhov's gun thing, where you know that's going to come into play later. And then the gun guy, like, gives her some pepper spray, too.
Right.
And they make a big thing out of, like, well, also take pepper spray. Like, you know that those things are going to come into it later.
Yeah, and it's the phone thing, too, right? Like, at first, it's all, turn off your phone, turn off your phone. And then the second half of the movie, it's like, I need the footage from the phone. I need to see the phone. And they don't even want to talk on a phone. They want to, like, watch a phone and stuff. But
eventually, Cage, especially after Simon visits him at school, Cage decides that he has to kill this guy.
Yeah,
like, he has to, and he does.
Yeah, there's this guy that he was supposed to, I guess, in theory, kill at the zoo. I don't know if he's going to, like, you know, bump him under the elephant's hooves, like, have the elephant, like, trample him.
Elephants have hooves?
If he showed up at the zoo, he was supposed to, like, call them and say, the guy's at the zoo. What's my next step? That's sort of how I saw it.
But, like, what's weird is that, like, here, you know, when he gets the next step, which is to kill the same guy, from the beginning, like, here's how you're going to kill him. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like he had to call in the situation, like, okay, like, he just got off the bus, what do I do? They're like, you're going to go here, he's going to get off the bus, you're going to bump him over the overpass, he's going to die. Like, they give him this whole plan from start to finish so that they can just sort of get out of there.
They call him and tell him to take the bus and meet this guy at the pedestrian ramp by the bus station, and at this point, Cage is acting so sketchy all the time, and especially around his wife, and his wife does not suspect in the least.
Nope.
Well, he's always she kind of does.
The bus today.
You know, you know, I think she kind of, because she's like, something's wrong, what's wrong, and this is where he's like, I'm going to lie to her for the rest of this, because, you know, he doesn't want her involved. That's the way I took it. But yeah, I definitely think she knows something's going on.
She even offers him. She's like, you know, I hear that sometimes, you know, the partner of the victim, they go through it. They have a hard time readjusting too. So she knows that something. Like, she knows that he's being weird, but she doesn't pursue it enough. I guess she's sort of like, maybe, you know, in this world we don't see it because we jump 6 months. Maybe he's like, you know, he gave her time. Like, you know, I know that you went through a horrible thing. I'm not going to be too close. Like, when you're ready to talk about it, we can talk about it. Maybe that's, she's just sort of giving him the same respect. I mean, we have no idea. I'm just sort of making excuses now.
Yeah.
I think she does notice, but she doesn't, like, pursue it. To make sure that he, you know, makes the kill, they slash his tires. And Janet Jones, like, later, she's like, how do they slash our tires? She's like, oh, it's easy. Like, anybody can just come in and just, like, slash our tires.
Yeah, like...
She's like, no, they can't. Like,
slashes the
about?
Tires of cars in a parking garage, like...
And it's probably, like, you know, a gated parking garage for their apartment building, right?
You know, I don't think she would live there if it wasn't some place that you needed, like, you need a card key to, like, get into the garage, or at least have to live there to get access to it. I mean, it's supposed to be a secure building.
And also someplace, apparently, you can install bars on your windows, so that's something.
And then doesn't he come home? Like,
he doesn't do the kill the first time.
Yeah, and Simon's been in his house again, right? He, like, rearranged the magnets. Yeah, choose. He rearranged the magnets on the refrigerator, and I don't even know why they have those magnets, because they don't have a kid.
No, they don't have a kid. I guess it's like I know that people have magnets, like, you know, adults have magnets, but those are definitely kid magnets.
Yeah.
It's like that maybe they were planning to have a kid, but, like, I feel like you don't buy magnets until you actually have the kid, and the kid can actually do something with the magnets.
Wait for the sonogram first.
But yeah, Guy Pearce basically says, choose. Like, either you're going to choose to kill that guy, or we're going to kill you and your wife. And, like, when it's done with that, like, of course, like, you're going to kill the guy. That's just what has to happen. So, like, they go through again, and he takes the bus again to work, and this time gets off, and this guy, this supposed pedophile, shows up, and Cage just sort of wants to talk to him. But the pedophile, quote-unquote pedophile, throws his bike at Cage and then sort of, like, fights with Cage and then just sort of falls off the overpass. And you see on the video footage or the replay, sort of, whatever, that Cage, like, reaches for him. And it looks like he's trying to save him, because we know that he's not trying to kill him. He's looking for answers. He's not seeking justice. He's seeking answers.
That was definitely weird, too, when he was like, I need to talk to you, and the guy just throws his bike at him. I was like, what's going on here? Because, you know, much like Cage, I'm led to believe this guy's a pedophile.
Right.
You know, I didn't know he was a, you know, award-winning investigative journalist who's trying to take down the justice seekers, you know? And I thought it was a pretty cool, you know, scenario that I wasn't expecting in this movie. I thought it would go down a much more generic path than it did, but when the guy sort of lunges at him and he ducks out of the way for safety and he falls over the overpass, onto that car,
right?
I was like, oh my man.
At this point I wrote in my notes, things falling off things look cool.
Well, it's the second time in this movie.
They did a really good job with the car falling off the top of the parking garage at the beginning, so these, whoever the director or the DP in this, they make things falling off things look great.
Well, maybe it's Simon, the character of Simon, who just loves using heights as a weapon.
That's true.
What I like about this movie, and this scene sort of reinforces it when the guy falls off the bridge, is for the most part this plays like a PG-13 movie. Like, it's so close, and then between language and, like, these scenes of violence, like, oh no, it's R. Like, they're playing the most part like it's sort of not conservative, but it's not going over the top.
Yeah.
But they're not scared to, like, ramp up the violence and, like, just, like, have a bloody death just because they can.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. It feels like they got close to an R because of the themes they're dealing with, like hard rape and, like, you know, killing vigilante style without a mask and stuff. And so, yeah, when they needed to, it's cool that they can actually take it where they need to and go as far as they have to. Yeah, I mean, it's not like they don't exploit it like Drive Angry by any means, but it's cool that it's there in their back pocket and they use it when they need to.
And so after Cage makes this kill, he goes back to school and understandably having a tough time. But I like that we were talking about earlier that he's, you know, basically preaching, don't be, or use your words, not your actions.
Yeah.
And then just punches him.
Yeah.
It seemed like, I looked down to write a note and I looked up. Was it an accidental punch or he actually he wound up and punched the guy?
Yeah. It's like he cannot practice what he preaches at this point. You know, like his entire, you know, personality is in question to himself, right? He's going through this, they're forcing him through like an existential crisis in a way.
Yeah. I mean, that's another generic thing is that like the good man. Man who's tainted by something he's forced to do, and it sets him down a path to ruin. Like, it's so textbook.
But what I kind of, like, again, I mean, I know, Larson, but what I kind of like about this...
I don't want to take the joy out of this.
He's playing... I just feel like this character is different than the sort you get in those types of thrillers, because, I mean, even when you get, like, Sinatra running around trying to figure out the plot and what's going on, like, they're very proactive guys,
right.
You know? And I feel like this character is doing everything... He's almost like the guy from Next. He's doing everything possible not to be involved in this situation.
Yeah, he's just kind of being washed along the running with the current.
And after Cage punches the kid, his best friend, Harold Perrineau, who I guess is the principal, maybe? He's some position of authority.
Yeah, he's a step higher than Cage.
And he sort of throws him under the bus. He's like, well, you know, hitting a kid, that's like a minimum 3 weeks. And like, you punch the guy, like, you know, you're going to take some time off. But then by the time Cage gets home and lies to January Jones about where he's been, Harold Perrineau's already called and, like, asked how he's doing. Like, dude, that's not your place. Like, why are you... What are you doing?
Yeah, totally blew up his spot in that situation.
Yeah.
Jerry Jones is like, oh, like, you had a half day? Like, then why did he call asking how you felt after you were suspended? And Cage's like, oh, sorry. Busted. Yeah.
You're home early?
Yeah. It was a half day. Student conferences.
That's funny, because Jimmy called me. Check on you.
What'd he say?
He said that you hit a student and got suspended.
Yeah, well, that kid is, he was just a total mess.
And that makes it right.
Thank you. Thank you, darling, for your support.
My support?
Yes, your support.
Here. Where did you get this? Where did you get it?
I can't tell you that.
You can't tell me?
I can't tell you, all right? It's not...
I'm going to rehearsal.
I think what they needed to do in that scene was get across the fact that, stop lying to me, kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, I know something's up. Tell me what's going on.
Yeah, like, I'm actually kind of shocked that he hasn't been straight up with his wife
about it yet.
Like, he continues to act sketchy about his wife. Like, Simon calls him, and he goes out to his car with the flat tires in the garage, and he's talking to Simon. He's I gotta go talk to my sister again, or I don't know, he makes some stupid excuse. And that's where there's like a cheap jump scare where one of the neighbors knocks on the window.
Yeah.
Parking garages are great for movies like this. Another cliche, but go on.
Well, just in regards to, like, he definitely should tell January Jones what's going on, because she's the only person he cares about that he needs to protect, you know? And so if she was in on it, she could act like she doesn't know what's going on, but still be ready to protect herself.
Yeah.
What I like about the scene about him not telling her is that it frustrates her enough to get up and leave, and I think that's maybe why he doesn't tell her here. Because they need to split up at this point so he can be alone, the cops can come in and arrest him. Because I think that if the cops came in while she was there, I don't know how that scene would play. I think it works much better because she leaves and then hears a knock and he's like, oh, did you come back? And no, it's the cops and they're there to arrest and they have a warrant for the arrest. And it's like this moves the plot along. So I think I think that it doesn't make sense that he doesn't tell her, but I can see why, to keep the pace going and sort of enter the second half of the movie, that they need to not tell her yet, because they need to get them separated and then get him into custody so that we can keep things moving.
Yeah, we still haven't found out about the guy he killed, who that guy really...
Right.
Like, there's still a lot more to get to, so I appreciate them, you know, skipping ahead.
Yeah, and he gets apprehended by the police, and he meets a bad lieutenant.
He does meet a bad lieutenant, which, by the way, so this I was telling you, I was teasing this to you, Mike. This guy, so we, movies and movies and movies ago, one of the first, like, 15 or 20 movies, we found out that Al Cerullo was in, like, 11 Cage movies. We
found the helicopter
the
guy,
helicopter
right?
pilot. Yeah. We found out that Cage's body double was also an extra in a bunch of movies. The lieutenant, I did not realize, has been in 4 Cage Club movies.
What?
So
we've seen.
That we've seen already. So Xander Berkeley, who plays the lieutenant, was in Leaving Las Vegas as a cynical cabbie. He was in The Rock as Lawner. He was uncredited, but he was in The Rock. And he was in Kick-Ass as Detective Gigante. So, like, it's not, like, movies okay. that we haven't seen yet. Oh, these okay. are all, like, legitimate, like, big releases.
Now that you say Kick-Ass, I definitely picture him in Kick-Ass. But those other two movies, they kind of feel like blink and you miss them.
Because, like, what's weird is that, like, he's a pretty prominent figure in this movie. Yeah. And in those, I don't really remember him, you know? Like, I feel like he's got a lot to do in this. It seems like he's not a nobody. I guess he sort of worked his way up from cabbie to conspiracy theory lieutenant, part of the shady organization.
Yeah.
Well, do you think that Cage's bad lieutenant would have put up with this nonsense if he was part of this force?
Or? I think if he was getting a cut, he would have. And so Cage is brought into the police station, and we get another interrogation sketch, another little good cop, bad cop, another little with Bob and David. And they're like, why would you kill an investigative journalist? Why would you kill this guy, Alan Marsh? Like, he was at the zoo. Like, do you know who he is? He's like, wait, what are you talking about? Like, investigative journalist? Like, first of all, I didn't kill anybody. Lie? Well, sort of a lie. Not really
kind
necessarily
a lie.
Kind of a lie. But also, I don't, like, investigative journalist, like, that, like, legitimately throws him for a loop. He's like, in his mind, like, I thought this guy was a pedophile.
And they have some of the footage, right? They're like, there's you, there's him, and here comes you again. Like,
yeah.
Tell us what happened down there. Like,
yeah,
they
yeah.
seriously don't
they
have
were
the
like,
footage
oh,
that proves you innocent.
Because Simon tells him, like, oh, we disabled the camera on the bridge, but, like, you know,
but the second
and
too?
Actually, you see the camera, like, during the scene, the initial scene. You see him walking past a clearly mounted camera.
You see how nice and subtle this movie is? You love it, Larson.
Anyway.
But yeah, so they say, like, conveniently someone forgot to load the tape that... Like, there's no way in 2011 that they're still recording to
on tape.
No. That it's just, you know, it's whatever. I guess it's just sort of, you know, cop lingo or whatever. But then, so he leaves and he goes into, like, a one-on-one with the lieutenant, this guy from these other movies, and the guy's like, you know... What day comes after Monday? What's my favorite color? Cage is like, my favorite color? Like, somewhere
dude,
like the day of tomorrow.
Yes, exactly. I thought Wicker Man so hard at this moment.
So in the Wicker Man, he's like talking, he's like, you guys, he's like, what's happening the day of tomorrow? And they're like,
I remember that.
Yeah, and he's like, oh, I thought it was a local saying. And she's like, what are you talking about? Yeah. Like, we don't say that.
And this lieutenant's just like, what's my favorite color? And Cage is like, you mean, what's my favorite color? He's like, yeah, what's my favorite color? He's like, I don't know, purple, like, whatever.
Yeah.
And then he says, what does a baby do when it's hungry? It's cry. And then, what does the hungry rabbit do? And Cage goes, jump.
Good afternoon, Mr. Gerard. I'm Lieutenant Durgan. I'm going to ask you a few simple questions. Just procedural, nothing to worry about.
I want a lawyer.
The day after Monday is...
I want a lawyer.
You haven't been charged with anything, Mr. Gerard. Day after Monday is...
Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. My favorite color is...
What the hell is this?
My favorite color is...
And my favorite color? Purple.
Purple. If a baby is unhappy, he...
He cries.
The hungry rabbit.
Jumps. The hungry rabbit jumps.
And then the guy. I love this scene. This
is
a great
crazy.
Reveal. Uncuffs Cage, gives him a visitor pass, and says, I'm going to leave 10 seconds later. I'm getting chills. I love this part because it's like, it's such a big conspiracy. Like, everybody's involved, and maybe I should have expected it, but this is, it's cool.
Well, here, I liked how important laminates come into the second half of this movie.
Laminates.
This is just the first of two laminates that get the job done. But what I loved was, like, okay, this guy's in on it. Anyone can be in on it. But he's the only one in on it at the police station because he's like,
well,
just get out of here, man. Like, right?
Well, he's the only one, I think, involved. But later in the movie, when Cage is on the loose and Simon's chasing him, there are the cops that are always after him, and they're on Simon's payroll.
Okay.
Because he's like, go after them. You remember? Like,
yeah, but so, then there's also the good cops, right?
There's always good cops and there's bad cops.
So I think there's just too many cops, whether they be in on it or not. I don't know.
But again, this conspiracy, like, blows my mind. Like, where is the money coming from? Like, how is their reach everywhere?
Well, like he said, like, this is just one cell. So, like, imagine stuff like Al-Qaeda, right? When they talk about cells yes, all over the world, you know? So, like, I mean,
if Al-Qaeda was worldwide, as effective as this bullshit conspiracy in this movie, then we would have a lot more to worry about.
But this is sort of the part of the movie, like, we're like an hour in, like, this is an hour 40. This is the, like, everybody's getting answers. That, you know, Jennifer Carpenter's hanging out with January Jones. Turns out Jennifer Carpenter's name is Trudy. I'm like, that's a terrible name. Why would you name anybody Trudy?
At least she has a name, right?
At least she has a name. But she's like, you know, you should demand answers. I'm like, wait, why is... I thought they were sister and girl and wife. Like, I'm like, oh, no, they just... I'm like, what's going on?
That was so
that's a weird scene.
That was the revelation that she is not the sister of Cage.
Yes.
And so she's demanding answers. She wants January Jones to get answers. Cage is finding out information about this investigative journalist, finds out where his wake is, and they're all, like, starting to, like, they're not, like, starting to piece the puzzle together yet, but they're all, like, basically getting the puzzle ready, and they're about to go find their first clues, kind of.
Okay, so when he goes to this wake, as someone who, like, kind of romanticized journalism growing
up.
Me too. Like,
yep. Mm-hmm.
Everyone at this wake is the most stereotypical, like, well, old school journalist. They're like, rumpled middle-aged men with loosened ties who are drinking scotch.
They're all Perry White, basically, from the first Superman
room
movie.
Full of Perry White.
But I also got a heavy Wire vibe from The Wire, because it's like an Irish wake, you know, and they did tons of those on that show, and it's just like, this guy's not even a cop. He's just a reporter.
Yeah.
And they're giving him, like, a cop funeral.
Yeah. Yeah.
It also looks a lot like the bar from Shameless. I don't know if it's the same set that Shameless, but, like, another sort of Irishy pub.
It's a very, like, European style.
Yeah.
Like,
well, it's New Orleans, so, you know, they got the history.
It's like that French vibe.
And they're all like, remember the time when
as long as you're buying, you're
buying the whiskey.
I also like that they all have, like, bad reporter jokes that, like, you know, I had lunch with them and I had, you know, something unexpected. What did he do? Did he pay for the bill? Like, that guy never pays for things. And also, the picture of him at the wake is just him flipping off the camera.
Yeah.
It's just like everything about this is like punk rock journalism in a room of Perry White. Like, I feel like this is the kid that, like, they all wanted to be. Like, they all, like, this was them either in their past or the journalist they never. So they just love this guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like this guy who, like, goes out and, like, rides a bike around town and, like, digs deep in these shadowy organizations.
Yeah.
And, like, flips off cameras.
One of the last true anti-establishment journalists.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? Like, it's so romanticized. And it's funny because everyone sort of joked about at the end of Man of Steel how, like, Clark Kent went to work at a newspaper. Like, come on, like, in, you know, 2014, you're going to go work at the newspaper. But then I think, like, how great if he turned into this kind of journalist, like someone that embeds himself overseas for, like, periods and has to break out of, like, Turkish prisons and things like that.
One thing I wanted to point out, because at the end of the scene, like, it sort of kicks the action going, before they go to the wake, he does fill January Jones in on the info. Like, they meet up before, and he's like, look, this is what's going on. And she gives him the gun. She's like, you're going to need this. Like, shit's going to go down.
Yeah.
I need you to have this gun. He's like, where'd you get that? She's like, don't worry about it. Like, I went through a rough patch there. It's like, they talk about it. She's like, I want a gun. He says no. Like, you have to know in your mind, like, she's going to get a gun.
Well, he's so preoccupied with his own shit, right? It's like he even forgets that he's married to her at times until he really needs her. And what I love about that moment where she is so level-headed about everything, you know? And, like, she's got her shit together, and she's just like, relax, honey. Like,
and she even says, like, I would have done the same thing. Like, don't take it personally. Like,
if
the roles were reversed or if they asked me that night, like, I would have said, kill the guy.
And I love that, too, that she's like, thank you, kind of, for, like, avenging me, you know? Like, this is okay. We'll get through this. Like, I think you did the right thing.
She's much cooler about it right away than I thought she would be.
And so at the wake, Cage is getting a little bit of the info about, you know, what this guy was working on. And they're joking about, like, how, oh, yeah, like, the shady organization, it was, you know, it was aliens or whatever. I'm like, oh, journalists. And then they're like, no, like, they actually sort of fill him in. Like, you know, but next time, you know, a cop wants to come in here, like, you better just show your badge. It's like, wait, where is this?
I totally thought they were going to beat his ass or something like that, but they don't. They just stop talking to him and drinking his free beer.
Well, they might have beaten his ass if the cops, the actual cops, don't show up.
Oh, that's right.
Runs out.
Because the bartender is part of the conspiracy.
Oh,
she spies Cage in the bar and makes a phone call.
Yeah. And Cage is on the run again. And again, this is like another generic conspiracy thing where he's running around town. He can't trust anyone. The cops are after him. The cops won't believe him.
Well, also, what sort of elevates it a little bit is this when we find out that Simon shows up, and this is when he directs the cops. He's like, get after him. So, like, everybody's in on it. Like, not only can he not trust the cops, like, he can't trust anybody. Like, aside from January Jones, and, like, we find out that not even his best friend, like, spoiler a little bit later, like, not even his best friend he can trust. Like, aside from January Jones, like, nobody is safe in this world. Like, everybody could be out to get him.
And they end up on a pedestrian ramp, very much probably the same pedestrian ramp where he killed the investigative jury.
Yeah.
Quote-unquote killed.
I was thinking of the ramp where he was collecting birds in Birdie.
Yes! I got a very similar.
And he's, like, climbing around. Like, he jumps over
crazy.
The edge and, like, goes... And it looks like it's him. Like, I don't know how high off the ground, but, like, it looks like he's doing his own stunts. And he's, like, climbing under roadways?
Under elevated highways.
It's insane.
It's really... I kind of like this little chase, though, too, because he, like, runs across the highway.
Yeah.
Dodges that truck.
The action scenes are very intense, and like, I remember thinking from when I was a kid, running across a highway is probably the scariest fucking thing you could ever do in your life.
Yeah.
And, like, he's running across multiple lanes of a busy highway. Like, they're chasing him, and it's, you can feel the tension.
Right.
Like, very well.
The tension kind of pops when, like, one of their guys gets obliterated by a truck. Like, that startled me and amazed me.
Yeah.
Like, this is another part where, like, you know, the movie's sort of PG-13. I'm looking down and making notes, you know, chasing, like, dodging trucks or whatever. And then I just look up, and a guy just gets, like, whacked by a truck. I'm like, what just happened?
Because,
like,
that makes it real.
Yeah.
That makes it, like, hey, this is what happens, like, in a split second if you try to run across a highway. You get dragged under the wheels of a SUV for a half a month.
And I keep thinking, this is like, Simon is very smart to get other people to do all this dirty work. He's got, like, all these cronies lined up, like, and I just imagine, like, they've all gotten entangled so deep, like, they're trying, like, Cage is almost tangled too deep, and they can't get out of it. And this poor guy, man, he gets dragged, and they show it, and it's like you're saying, right? Like, they go for the R here, and it's worth it.
And so, as Cage is kind of getting away, and, like, things aren't going well for him, but he sort of escaped the clutches, like, he sort of dodged them a little bit, January Jones gets picked up by the quote-unquote cops, and, like, in their car, she recognizes that the guy, because earlier in the movie, I think, Simon had come up to them at dinner, and just sort of, like, you know, this is before Cage had told her, and he's just, like, being like, oh, we used to teach together, and basically saying, like, I can find you wherever you are, you're never safe. And then when he leaves... January Jones sees this other guy leave with him, and then she realizes, I think, right, that she recognizes the guy who's driving her is with Simon, and Cage has filled her in, and so this is when Chekhov's pepper spray comes out, and she just blasts both guys and runs out. So I like, you know, as sort of an object of a woman as she is to propel the plot, she does hold her own here and is able to actually sort of get the job done and protect herself.
Mm-hmm.
Is this when Cage uses his second laminate, the one that he stole from the wake, and he goes to the
office. He goes to the newspaper.
He goes to the newspaper, right? I don't quite remember what he found out there, though. Does he find the lockbox, or that there's a lockbox?
No, so what he finds out, he goes to where this guy, Alan Marsh, the investigative journalist, he goes to his office.
The Boston... where are they?
New Orleans, I think.
Oh, the New Orleans,
New Orleans Post.
New Orleans Post, that's right.
And what I like is that he walks in, he sort of comes in, like, basically enters through the exit, like the truck exit, and sees, like, the day's newspaper.
Oh, that's
just
great.
His face just says, suspect wanted.
Yeah. And this is, again, sorry to keep calling these out,
but
a great conspiracy movie cliche where he's walking around, and he's constantly has his hand over his face.
Yep.
Like, he's like, kind of subtly wiping his nose, but he's always got his hand over his eyes, and, like, he's looking back and forth.
And by this point in the movie, Cage had lost his cell phone, so January Jones, the cell phone that he had snuck back in a school, and it's all convoluted, but he loses his cell phone by this point. And so January Jones can't get in touch, but he goes to this guy, Alan Marsh's desk, and he's, like, rooting around, and this woman asks him, like, about capitalization, amazing. And because he's an English teacher, it pays off, and he gives it. But then she's like, wait a minute, he's at a dead guy's desk, who is this guy? But I'm like, lady, know your A1, know your front page. This picture is literally on the front page of tomorrow's newspaper.
You work for the newspaper.
Yeah.
Come on.
And it's like, it was cute when Lois Lane couldn't spell, like, correctly, but you work at the newspaper. Like, you should know what you're asking, I feel.
Well, I feel like, as with a journalism background, there are so many, like, complicated rules that you sort of, like, do overthink yourself sometimes.
Okay.
And, like, the examples he gives about when things are capitalized, I feel are not hyphenated. Like, Homeland Security is not a hyphenated word.
He goes into so much detail, too.
Like,
it needs to be, like, a quarter length of what he responds with.
Hey! In a hyphenated compound situation, do you capitalize the second word?
Only if it's a noun and the words have equal weight. Like, Homeland Security. If it's a participle modifying the first word, then you better keep it lowercase.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Thanks.
And he goes to this desk, and what he finds is a stack of receipts.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then he leaves the newspaper place, and then just goes to a fancy hotel, and just walks in the coat check closet, and just steals a coat, and then the coat has a valet key, and so he gets this bumping, you know, something like, I don't
Cadillac,
know if it's Ludacris,
right?
Or somebody that sounds like Ludacris, just like with this Cadillac Escalade. The guy's like, yo, man, nice car. And then Cage, you know, turns off the music and finds out that this journalist went to this one gas station over and over and over again.
Yeah. Another conspiracy movie cliche, series of clues.
Oh, yeah. So
like a key in a pocket, a receipt that leads you to a hotel, that leads you to a car, that leads you to a storage unit.
But I like that but it makes sense how we do it here. Like, he has to actually go find the receipts, and then the car is completely unrelated to the journalist. Like, he just basically steals this car.
That was a pretty smooth move, I thought. You know, I hadn't seen that in a film before. Just steal a coat and use the ticket inside to
transportation. It's awesome. Like, I can't believe that's never been in a movie.
Yeah.
Believe I haven't done that.
Now we're all going to try it. But when I heard the storage unit, I definitely thought Silence of the Lambs. You know, I was like, okay, like, maybe we're trying to cram a couple too many things in here. But it does play for me. He does find the lockbox.
He gets to the gas station and bribes the guy with $20.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, hey, you recognize this guy? Like, he shows a laminate, and the guy's like, oh, yeah, I've seen him around. He's like, here's a little bit of sweet. Like, you want to... Where can I find this boat?
Yeah, he's trying to get a ride to Summer Isle,
puts
right?
$20 down. Yeah. In The Wicker Man, he bribes a guy with $100. Here, he bribes a guy with $20, then gets the info and gives him another $40. Like, that's not how bribery works, Keith.
Yeah, no, that's paying for information, right?
But the guy basically says, yeah, you know, number 22 out there,
but
I've seen people back into it and the doors have broken.
Oh, yeah. Very convenient.
And so Cage just, instead of backing into it, just drives straight into it. And the guy coincidentally gets a newspaper delivered, sees Cage on the front page. You know, this guy checks the front page, unlike the woman in the journalism office in the newspaper building, and calls the cops. And just as, like, it's...
But what, is it like... Like 6 in the morning? Like, when are papers getting delivered? Is it the evening edition?
No,
yeah,
probably,
it's probably the middle of the night.
It's in the middle of the night? Okay, that kind of threw me too, because I was like, he needs to know that Cage is wanted somehow.
Right,
And then I was like, oh, here comes the newspaper.
And also, another on my cliche list is that Cage finds in the storage unit a box of evidence. And it's like documents and
camcorder.
CD-ROMs and videotapes. And you know, it's all the most generic, like...
And it's a good thing he stole this 2011 Escalade with a DVD player in it.
That was crazy. I'd never seen that in a movie before.
Yeah.
Well, because I feel like that only would happen in a movie for, like, a 2-year span. Like,
when
DVD players were cars were cool, but before people stopped buying DVDs.
Yeah.
Like, there's a very tight window when that would actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the exact car that they need. And Cage finds the footage from the beginning of the movie that the movie starts out with.
Yeah.
That's the investigative reporter sort of finding out information about this organization.
I mean, basically, it's a box of stuff that's going to bring the whole conspiracy down.
And he calls Simon, and this is when he sends that HD quality video from his Nokia phone.
Yes.
And he's like, oh, I have something you want, you have something I want.
Yeah.
Let's trade.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they go and meet at the monster
the
truck
monster
rally.
Truck show.
This is when Cage gets to do his little, I feel like the movie knew Simon was being ridiculous with all of his little missions because Cage gets to send him on some errands too.
That was pretty great.
Wild goose chase.
On the way to the monster truck place, when he's avoiding the cops, we get another almost train jump that he gets up to the train.
Yeah. I thought that
this is from Next, Racing with the Moon. But unlike Next, where he has unlimited lives, he's got God mode, he only has one life in this, and he just slams the brakes, I can't jump a train.
Yeah.
It's I've learned from my mistakes from Next.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't do that. Yeah, but then you go to the monster truck show, and it's just go take a leak. Go buy a hot dog. It's just wait, what are you doing, Cage? You're just you're just having fun with your
he's
power.
He's just messing with him.
Right. I feel like he's getting back at him that way, too. He's you see, this is what you've been putting me through.
Yeah,
doing it the shorthand.
I also earlier in the movie when Simon's doing that to Cage and is saying, buy a ticket to the zoo, pay in cash. I'm I don't carry that much cash around. I can't just buy a zoo ticket. Hold on. I need to go to the ATM, Simon. Let me go get some cash.
Yeah.
Or can I use my credit card? I don't know.
He's very presumptuous.
Although using a credit card, a National Treasure, it gets you into trouble.
You don't want to leave a paper trail.
No paper trail.
Well, one of the things, I knew that when he found the box of evidence and he called Simon, I knew it was going to lead to one of the generic handoffs in one of these conspiracy movies. But
we don't really.
I didn't. I just kind of figured, he was going to be I'll give you the evidence, and you leave me alone forever.
Are you Liam Neeson? Who are you right now?
This is my cage. I'm working on it for this.
You need more work.
But it's at a monster truck show,
at the Superdome, this massive thing, and then there's apparently just conveniently an abandoned mall next door. God.
Well, we'll get to that.
Now, before that, the audience is privy to a huge reveal.
Right,
that his friend Harold Perrineau
is a bad guy. He's in on it.
Is part of the Justice Seekers, and that kind of made everything sort of click. I was I'm glad they did that because it makes sense that he told Guy Pearce to go to the to go to the hospital that night and go talk to Cage and offer your services.
Because that's what we find out, right? But that he did it for him. He's I was mad for you, right?
Yeah, I thought you'd want this.
I want to make sure your wife was avenged.
I know, Jimmy. What do you know? I saw the pictures. You and Simon. You're part of this.
Look, Will, listen to me. Okay, I'm a part of the organization. Okay, I joined 15 years ago when my brother got killed. They didn't even catch the bastard. I had to do something. So, I'm sorry. That fucking scumbag that raped Laura? I wanted him crucified.
Who set me up for the murder of that reporter? Huh? Was it you, you fuck?
I called Durden. Told him to let you go. That was me.
What's Simon's real name?
Will, I can't tell you that. You have no idea what this guy is capable of.
His name.
I'm your fucking friend.
No! You're Simon's friend! You tell me his fucking name! What's his name?
His best friend represents what the organization is supposed to be.
Yeah, doesn't he even say at times where he's we all started following Simon and now he's gone rogue and it's getting out of control and it's not what
it
should be.
That happens when they get to the... Because the abandoned mall gets brought up because they finally meet at the Monster Truck Show. And then the abandoned... the phrase abandoned mall is
it's
great.
From Katrina. It was never restored.
Post-Katrina New Orleans.
Which
we tapped into a couple times. Seeking Justice, our Bad Lieutenant was all about that, too.
Entirely.
Very specific in time. And, you can sort of, there's kind of no rules. Just New Orleans is this sort of...
the Wild West
outlaw town.
Yeah.
But before we get there, actually, we skipped something. Is that when Cage is, in his car that he calls... Simon, they're gonna meet at the Monster Truck Show. He gets carjacked, he's about to get killed by this stranger, and he just starts yelling. He's like, "The hungry rabbit jumps, hungry rabbit jumps." The guy's like, "Wait, how do you know what that means?"
Oh yeah.
That's right.
I was
some
totally
nervous,
forgot that
some
part.
Nervous middle aged man
tries
to kill him.
Yeah, they told that guy that Cage was a pedophile.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, he's like, you know Simon, right? Like, you like, yeah. Like, yeah, I know Simon. Like, yeah. We all know Simon.
It's amazing that, like, none of the other marks have been like, wait a minute, Simon. Like, I know, yeah. Like, throws up the sign, the gang sign, or says the magic words.
What I also am surprised about is, like, it also seems like Simon's the kind of guy who would give every guy a different name or a different phrase or something. Like, I understand for simplicity, both in the organization and the movie, it has to be one phrase, it has to be one guy. But it seems like, because basically, you know, the investigative journalists and the cops sort of know that the hungry rabbit jumps means something.
Yeah, yeah.
So just have some kind of animal and some kind of action, or some kind of this and that, and have a different name. Because this is just like setting yourself up to be caught. That if everybody you're dealing with, and I know that they're eventually going to die, you know, just a couple days later in theory, but if everybody knows who you are, what you look like, what your supposed name is, and this phrase, you have all the information you need to, like, turn this guy in.
Well, that's the same argument about, like, why does James Bond keep calling himself James Bond?
Right, everyone already recognizes him. Yeah. Well, what I thought was, speaking to that, though, Joey, is it's sort of that phrase that gets them in trouble, too, right? Like, it's because they all communicate with that one phrase that the journalist gets it on tape. And it's like, that's the evidence. It's like, oh, no, like, our secret code is going to get published.
And we finally get to that abandoned mall, and sort of, again, I bring this up every time it happens, like, everybody we know in the movie is in this location. We've got Cage, we got January Jones, we got Harold Perrineau, we got Simon. I think Trudy might be there, too, Jennifer Carpenter, or maybe she's not, but she's, like, around.
Yeah.
Like, everybody's in this one place. Like, everybody we know and care about is here, and Cage, like, his... I can't believe this works. I guess it has to work for the movie, but he, like, what works is that he says to Simon, "You're insane." Simon's like, "What'd you say?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not insane." Like, this is what Mike was saying before. And like, then they, no, the world is sick. Yeah. I'm not sick. The world is sick.
And then the generic villain speech at the end, where he explains why he's doing what he's doing and shows that he's maybe a little insane.
You're insane.
What did you say?
I said, I think you're sick.
On the contrary, I am very well. You don't see it, do you? This city and how close we are to absolute chaos. Jimmy sees it, don't you, Jimmy? Sick. I'm not sick. The sick ones are sitting on their fat fucking asses, eating and drinking and fucking themselves into a stupor, polluting the world without a second thought while it goes down the toilet. Nobody wants to do the nasty work, Will. You know, the shit that we all just think about. Most good citizens are just along for the ride and then fucking bitch and moan and complain about everything when it doesn't work out. But not me. Get it done.
I thought it was pretty funny. Like, I knew what they're going for at that point because, you know, it's like calling Marty McFly chicken, you know? It's just like this shorthand. And I love that it bothers Simon because I'm starting to get that feeling that, like, he is crazy and insane and everyone around him is just too scared to tell him. So it's kind of funny that Cage, like, throws that out and it really does bother him.
Yeah, I feel like it would have served the movie better to introduce this part of his personality earlier. Like, he's just kind of a shady taskmaster up until now.
Yeah, you don't know their mission.
Yeah, and only at the end do you see that he's this, like, unhinged megalomaniac.
He thinks he's doing justice.
Yeah, he knows what's right for everyone. And, like, if that was part of his personality earlier, it would have made him a more compelling character.
And so after he sort of espouses his misguided worldview, he and his, like, number one thug pull guns on him and John Cage and Jerry Jones, like, you know too much, like, we can't let you out of here. Like, we're not going to make it look like a suicide, we're just going to kill you and dump you and leave you for whatever. Ultimate reversal, what's great is that Harold Perrineau saves the day.
Yeah.
And what's cool is that, like, it makes sense in terms of just, you know, going back to Larson, cliche, like, his friend saves him. But also what's cool is that in his mind, in the character's mind, he says to Simon, you said they were never going to get hurt. Like, this is not what I signed up for. And if you're going to cross the line, I'm going to cross the line. And they mean more to me than you do. So, like, this is enough.
Mm-hmm. I really felt like they did his character a good service. Like, not only making him part of the big twist, but also here having him be, you know, the other turn of the other twist where he's going to help his friends out. And, his actions are totally justified by Simon going overboard and everything.
And there's a lot of great stuff in this shootout. The slide down the elevator, escalator bank. Like, it makes me feel like this movie could have benefited from a lot more action set pieces because the highway chase,
yeah,
and the ending shootout were so good. They could have. I mean, I'm sure budget was an issue, but
they had this mall. They should have had a car chase through this mall, right? Yeah. Like, that would have been a la Blues Brothers.
That's what I was thinking. It's like, if you have an access to an abandoned mall. Mm-hmm. Like, I would have done a whole movie in an abandoned mall if I had access to it.
One thing that doesn't really ring true for me here is that Cage, at one point, pins down Simon and just starts beating the shit out of him. Like, basically, you know, again, it could add to the beatdown by bare hands, like, up to four or five in Cage Club.
Close.
Like, he could keep going. And J.J. Jones, like, who basically has been on board with everything Cage has been doing, says, stop, don't kill him. And that's enough to give Simon the upper hand, and they sort of tumble off. And it looks like they're both going to fall to their death, but instead, they just fall to a thing like 6 feet down.
Yeah.
And they just fall down the escalator, and she's like, oh, okay.
Well, that scene, again, goes back to the whole thing about a man who's being turned to the dark side, mm-hmm. you know? Like, he's savagely punching Simon in the face. When his wife calls for him to stop, he turns and there's blood all over his teeth.
Right.
Like, you're looking at this guy who was a mild-mannered English teacher, and now he's a man who's got, like, blood all over him and is about to beat a man to death.
Yeah, I get that this is not the man that January Jones married, but, like, it's the one that she sort of has to accept that he's become, if only for her, right?
Well, sure.
Well, yeah, and he's gone, like, completely primal now, too, right? Like, this whole ordeal has sort of gotten down to the core of him, and he needs to be, like, an animal here at the end in order to survive.
And it's sort of that thing, like, where if you kill this man now, you're going to be just as bad as him. Like, you're going to become him.
Which is why I like that he doesn't end up killing the guy.
Well, of course he does.
And then the day is sort of saved when that shady in-on-it lieutenant shows up. And it's just like, oh, you know, this is one of those classic, both guys fill each other with bullets. Like, you know, they both put five bullets at each other. You know, that's something that always happens. Like, this is New Orleans. Like, okay, she's like, can you get away with that? He's like, this is New Orleans. Like, we can get away with anything.
But it's like, yeah, it's Chinatown, kid. But it's also like, no, you know, 7 out of 10 times we pull this stuff, it ends this way. So, you know, this is just, you know, business as usual for the justice seekers.
But what I like is that he sort of offers Cage, like, the opportunity that this is not, like, because Simon's dead, like, the organization's not dead, and it's kind of like, you know, we could rebuild it, like, we can make it in your image. He's like, no, I don't want any part of this. Like,
he offers him a job.
Yeah.
I wrote that early on when the guy who kills his wife's assailant, I was like, okay, Cage is going to be the new Simon by the end of this movie. Like, that was one of my predictions, but no, he doesn't become the new Simon.
No,
he turns it down.
He's got morals. He says no.
Yeah, exactly.
And he tries to do things good. Like, after the scene ends, we find out that his name has been cleared on the news. They're like, you know, local man. You know,
it's all part of New Orleans, right, Joey? Like, at the end, everything comes up roses for the
everybody
character.
Everybody comes up roses. And then he decides, like, he's like, all right, I'm going to do a good thing. I'm going to, you know, bring this research to, is, I don't know if it's a cop or a journalist or whatever.
It was one of the guys from the bar, from the wake. The guy was like, yeah,
what if it's alien stories?
Yeah. So he's like, here's all the research. Like, it's not a lot, but, like, it's a start. Like, you can go. He's like, yeah, and by the way, Hungry Dog jumps, and Cage is like, what? This guy's in on a
jump.
Like, I can't do anything. And, like, then movie ends. Like,
yeah,
great.
Boom.
I thought it was a cool gut punch to end the movie. Like, it's sort of, I guess, maybe predictable.
See,
you're just shaking your head.
I'm sorry. I was, like, I knew, like, the bloody hero and the wife walk off
just
arm
leave it
in
there.
Arm, cliche. But I was like, no, they're not done cramming cliches down our throat. There's going to be a twist ending. And of course there was, because he hands the evidence over to a guy who's already part of the conspiracy.
Well, one thing I kind of like that I didn't say about the newspaper or the TV news report is that, like, as you can tell by this footage, like, he clearly didn't kill a guy. It's like, well, no, like,
no,
it's like they fly and then the one guy's like,
questionable, right?
It's not really that cut and dry. Like,
as you can tell from this grainy black and white footage.
Yes.
He is completely.
And they're playing the footage on television. Why is the? Is it? Would it be played on? Wouldn't they just say he's been cleared of charges and all that? Can
a
trial or something
us
like
stuff
that
on TV? Yeah. Like, you don't see the guy die. You see
but you
the guy
see
him fall to his death.
Yeah,
she's like, you might want to divert your eyes. She doesn't say warning or anything.
Journalism up top. That's all I have to say about this movie. Anything else, Larson? I know you. Well, I guess we didn't sell you on it, but Mike, did you like it?
Yeah, no. I'm sorry, Larson. I was into this movie. I mean, you know, at first I had no idea what it was about. When we started off, I was getting all of this imagery I'm familiar with, New Orleans and this, you know, Cage dancing in that mask. And I was like, this is wonderful. Like, this is great. And Yeah, it sort of settled in. Like, I don't know. Like, it went fast at first, you know? And then when it settled in, I was already, like, into it. By the time that second act came around, I was like, okay, it's got me. Let's see where this thing goes. And, yes, it's generic and all that, but I feel like the actors are elevating the material. And,
yeah, no.
You know, they definitely make it a lot better than, you know, people are expecting it.
Like, as cliche as this movie may be, Larson, you have to at least give it credit for having, like, a legitimate Guy Pearce actor be the villain instead of some, like, washed up, like, you know, who's the guy from Sharknado? Ian Ziering. Like, they could have, like, an Ian Ziering type.
So I'm supposed to give it credit because it had enough budget to hire someone who was...
Yeah. Yes.
Well, maybe. I mean, they have... It's all about the caliber, right? Like, that's how I feel. Like, you've got January Jones in there, who's on a hit show, doing a good job there. You got Cage, who's, like, this vet. And then you have someone like Guy Pearce, who's always put in a great performance.
And you also have Jennifer Carpenter from another hit show, Dexter's On. You have Harold Perrineau from a show that just ended.
Like, yeah, they could have gone with a TV actor for the main villain.
Again,
and I just appreciate that they did it.
You're selling this based on the fact that the budget allowed for higher caliber actors. Like,
no, but I'm also saying that
it's
not like they're all like looking for paydays. Like, they all saw something in the script and they all saw something like a story that they wanted to tell.
Yeah, I feel like everyone showed up to make this movie. You know, like, we've sat through movies that just feel like they've sleptwalked.
There's no bad performances in this. The script might be cliche, but they all like try.
But see, they're like, I don't think this is bad. I think it's generic. I think everything about
it
is
generic. But is it a good type of generic?
Like, because you can't really laugh at it, you know? Like, it pulls it off in certain ways. There are only times where you can groan.
It's not bad, is it? Do you think it's bad?
No, I think it's worse than bad. Mediocre.
No. Mediocre is better than bad, isn't it?
No, because bad, at least you can enjoy. Like,
but you should be able, then, to enjoy this bad movie on that level where you can laugh at how, in your mind, it's not pulling off those cliches. You know, like, how rote it is and how, you know, how cute it seems because it's trying so hard. Whereas I look at it and go, I think they did a good job.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that it succeeds in its genericness. Like, it's very successful at being generic.
So
it takes all the elements.
You love it.
It takes the framed guy on the run who's afraid of the cops and afraid of the bad guys and can't win, and his wife gets raped and murdered or whatever. Like, it's all there.
It should,
like,
be a canon film, right?
They take all of it and they put a little twist on it. They tweak it just a bit and they do it well.
Like, on my list of favorite Cage movies, this is more toward the middle than the bottom.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, this is, you know, no Bad Lieutenant.
Maybe we're overselling it a little bit.
No, yeah. We are overselling it, but, I mean,
it's,
you know, we also...
the middle of the bottom, yeah.
No, not the middle of the bottom. Oh. In the middle, not the bottom.
Oh, okay.
Like, I'm not saying it's amazing and that, you know, you have to see this film, but it is I think it's a Cage film worth watching.
Yeah.
You know, I think you could skip, like, Guarding Tess, perhaps. Yeah, you could skip Amos and Andrew, you know, maybe Time to Kill. Like, there's ones you can skip, but, like, this, you could do a lot worse.
One thing I want to point out from the credits is that the guy who rapes January Jones is credited as Hodge, in parentheses, rapist. So if you're like, who was that guy? Hodge.
Hodge.
See, I definitely thought he was going to be credited as Snake Boots.
Yes, because they make a big...
They made a big deal of that.
They made a big thing about his snakeskin boots.
And then they just off him.
That would have as much resonance in the film as the necklace or the gun.
Fry Boots gets a special thanks shout-out, so maybe the boots did get a little bit of props. Any last thoughts about Seeking Justice? Larson loves it. Mike, any last thoughts?
No, not necessarily. I mean, this was like a nice surprise. Like, you know, I knew nothing about it. I went into this.
Joey's looking at me as Mike is saying this, and he's like,
I've sort of, you know, I'm not at this point in Cage Club. You might not want to trust everything I have to say.
Well, no, I mean, I feel like maybe you guys are just maybe biased.
A couple movies.
You think so?
A couple movies lately, Mike hasn't been crazy about, or Mike's really liked, and I haven't been crazy about. Like, he likes Season of Witch way more, but a lot of the time, most of the time, we do agree, and like this one, we both like this movie. So I think that if you like Cage, like we like Cage, you will like this movie.
Oh, one last thing. If you watch the Trailer Park Boys, Nicolas Cage in this movie looks like a skinny version of Julian.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He looks a lot like this, minus the bleached blonde hair, like he looks in Drive Angry. He's got, like, the sort of
the goatee
and the sort of the ear length.
Slick back hair.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Larson, thank you for joining us on this very special live edition of Cage Club.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly been an experience.
And I don't know how this is going to sound. We're going to have to play it back later, but I think this went great.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. I hope we get to do it again sometime.
So for all things Cage, you can go to cageclub.me. You can read our reviews, find past podcasts, follow us on Twitter, rate, review, subscribe on iTunes. All things Cage, cageclub.me. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
That's Christian Larson, and we'll see you next time on Cage Club.